and welcome to the Ship.Energy podcast. My name is Mark Williams, and I'm the contributing editor to Ship.Energy, your internet guide to shipping's pathway to decarbonization. My guest on the podcast this week is Mr. Daniel Rose, the Chief Executive Officer of LQM Petroleum Services in London. Dan has a 20-year career in shipping. He started out in Lloyd's MRU's credit reporting department, including 6 years in Barcelona with them, focused on the Mediterranean markets. And in 2010, he became the risk manager for Rudder, part of the D'Amico group of shipping companies, before moving on to be director of Integrate Fuels, which is part of the Navigate, the Figure Eight group of companies. So they, under his tutelage, under his guidance, became a well-known bunkering brand before he moved on to become the chief commercial officer of Ocean Connect Marine, which at that time was owned by Glencore, the big trading house. And then in October 2019, Daniel became CEO of LQM Petroleum Services, the well-known bunkering brand. And given that we're now on, I think, our seventh podcast, I thought it was about time that we heard from somebody in the bunkering industry, because we've had ship owners and we've had ship brokers and we've had environmental campaigners and we've had Bob Sanguinetti from UK Chamber of Shipping on. So it was about time that we actually heard from somebody who's in the bunkering industry, seeing as decarbonization is all about future fuels. Now, for the benefit of our listeners, Daniel hosted a webinar last week in which he discussed future fuels with guests from Pacific Green Technologies, which is a scrubber manufacturer, with CLNG.org, the organization that promotes the use of LNG as a marine fuel, and myself. So I was very happy to be a guest on his webcast. And so it seemed a good opportunity to get Daniel to join our podcast to discuss one particular output from that webinar. Especially because the participants, and I think there were over 200 of them, were invited to respond to a survey about the different pathways to IMO 2030 compliance. And as we're always interested in what the industry thinks about that, this seemed a good moment to find out what those results were. So, Daniel, welcome to the podcast. Good to have you here. So, Daniel, I want to get straight into this. Your survey asked respondents to consider the three different pathways to compliance with IMO 2030, which is the 40% reduction in CO2 emissions. So can you describe those different pathways that you asked people to respond to, and which pathway was deemed by the respondents to be the critical path to compliance?
Yeah, so this question was really built around the structure of the webinar session last week. You know, this is a very broad topic. It was a little bit ambitious of us to try and break it down in a one-hour webinar, perhaps. But we kept things along three tracks, three pathways to decarbonization, as we see it. One is an operations and technology pathway, which includes things like carbon capture, scrubbers, low steaming, operational efficiencies, solar, wind, etc. The other is what we call the future fuels pathway. So that's things like LNG, biofuels, hydrogen, ammonia, LPG, and so on. And finally, we have the policy pathway, which is the IMO regulations, regional regulations, potential for cap and trade schemes, and that sort of thing. And it seems that our audience on the day felt that pretty much all three of these pathways were pretty much equally important. The most popular pathway was the policy pathway, which scored an average score of 4.33 out of 5, followed closely by future fuels at 4.36 out of 5. And finally, the operations and technology pathway was a little lower at 3.82, but overall, all considered to be very important pathways towards decarbonization.
Now, I have to say, when I first saw that result, I read that as no clear winner. But actually, going a bit more closely into the nuances of that, there is a first, second, third place in that, isn't there? So that in first place was a little by a nose, you might say, policy pathway. And then in the photo finish, coming second at the line was the future fuels pathway, and then half a tail behind was the operations and technology pathway. And to me, that says, I don't know who the respondents to the survey were, but let's assume that they were mostly buyers, sellers of marine fuels, and interested third parties. So that to me says, well, most of them are passing the buck over to the policy pathway. They're saying, okay, IMO, okay, regulators, national, regional regulators, European Commission, IMO, and so on. It's up to you. You tell us what to do, and then we'll do it. And then they're saying future fuels pathway. So, you know, somebody please come up with the fuel. We don't care if it's LNG, biofuel, hydrogen, LPG, ammonia, fairy dust, wind, whatever it is, just tell us and we'll use it. And then the third level of choice after that would be the operations and tech pathway, saying, okay, now we'll go ahead and invest in the technology to burn the fuel, which is compliant with the regulations. Is that the way around you see it going?
Well, to me, my sort of hot take on this is that, you know, they are all largely equally important. An awful lot of work needs to be done in each of these pathways by all components of the sector, whether it's producers, traders, and the final end users of these fuels. An awful lot of work needs to be done. An awful lot of question marks remain. And I see them being, and I think the audience saw them, we all being as equally important to a large extent, yeah.
I don't know if you've been following the IMO's MEPC this week. There has been some discussion. There's the Twitter sphere has gone a bit loud over this in the last day or two.
Correct. I think we're seeing some news trickling out of the IMO this week, yeah.
And it seems a number of commentators have been underwhelmed, it has to be said, by the IMO's latest efforts to promulgate regulations on this matter.
I'm sort of hearing similar echoes from my part of the industry as well. From my point of view, I think the industry does need some leadership in this and this issue. We did actually go close to asking our audience who should be leading this these initiatives in our survey, and we asked our audience the question, or we made the statement and asked them to respond to it. We said shipping's path to decarbonisation should be guided and policed by the IMO. What are your thoughts? And we had a largely unanimous agreement. 91% of the audience felt that shipping's path to decarbonisation should be guided by the IMO, and only 9% dissented in any sort of way. So I think people are still looking to the IMO for solutions and guidance. When you have certain regions around the world, for example, the EU, are also carving their own path, and I think it possibly makes it harder for the or possibly leaves space for the IMO, less space for the IMO to operate if other organizations are doing more, or at least making more noise about it. As you know, Mark, I think the EU wants to put shipping in a kind of a cap and trade scheme, as it has done with aviation. And you know, I think the IMO needs to respond to that, because it could be inevitable that that's the way that the market goes. But without any other solution from the IMO, it's much more likely to happen.
Yeah, I think by and large I'd agree with that. If the IMO doesn't drive the agenda, then it leaves a vacuum into which other organizations will be sucked, and you know, they'll take up that vacuum and they'll add air to the conversation from their direction. So yeah, so that's interesting. So people think the IMO and regulators have to take the lead, but they also believe that from the survey results, I think that the industry therefore will be able to comply with what the regulations may end up being.
Yeah, the general view amongst the audience, because we also made the statement, which read as follows: the shipping industry will be able to comply with IMO 2030. And 76% of the audience agreed with the statement about its ability to achieve IMO 2030 compliance. Only 6% strongly disagreed with that statement. So people feel it's possible. People seem to concur that it's going to happen via these three main pathways, but there are certainly a number of big question marks along the way.
Yeah. Do you think, did the respondents therefore think that, let's say it's going to be a cap and trade, and everyone thinks they'll probably be able to get along with that, they'll find a way to trade to that. Do the respondents or did you find a question to ask them about, do they think that the incentives are going to be there for them to comply?
Well, the survey picked up on two parts of this. In response to, are there sufficient financial incentives to make this happen? It was a resounding no from the audience. So we made the statement, there are sufficient financial incentives for shipping to decarbonize. The audience largely disagreed with this statement. 30% actually strongly disagreed, and 48% just disagreed, meaning that only a minority of 21% felt that there was actually sufficient financial incentives. However, what I found really interesting is that we also put in front of our audience a spectrum of tools towards IMO 2030 compliance and asked them to rank the importance of each one. And one of those tools was utilizing current fossil fuels and carbon offset as a tool to achieving IMO 2030 compliance, which I thought would be quite a popular tool to achieve IMO 2030 compliance. There are shipping companies, for example, like Berger Bulk and others, that are already going down this road towards compliance. So the fuel already exists. It's available at scale and it's relatively cheap. It's energy dense. And they are balancing their carbon output by entering into carbon offset agreements and so on. However, this was actually ranked as one of the least popular tools to actually achieve IMO 2030 compliance, which I found to be really interesting. In context, the participants actually rated wind as a more viable or valuable tool to reach IMO 2030 compliance. And that, to me, is a largely experimental technology at this time.
Yes, until we all go back to sailing wheat from Australia in clippers in grain races, then the Flettner rotor experiments or the rotor sail experiments are ongoing, mostly in the Baltic region. I think there are a number of vessels in the North Sea and Baltic region that are using those rotor sails at the moment. So more popular with your audience than fossil fuel and carbon offsetting.
Yeah. Slow steaming was slightly more popular than wind, which to me makes a certain amount of sense as a sort of quick and dirty solution towards reducing carbon intensity. But we also have to remember that when a vessel is slow steaming, its engines are not running at their most efficient way. So yes, they might not be producing as much carbon, but they're probably producing more carbon per ton burned than they would be if they were running at their designed operational speed.
Yes, and they always have the opportunity to speed up again and to emit sort of more CO2 if and when market conditions allow. So it's not a permanent fix, is it, the slow steaming fix? People have talked about enforcing speed limits on the oceans. I'm not sure how many traffic cops it would take to do that.
True, but I thought these days with the improvements in sophistication of satellite tracking and so on, it shouldn't be too difficult. I don't see it as an insurmountable problem.
Mm. Was there one particular technology or fuel which the respondents believed was the leading contender for decarbonisation?
Yeah, so there were three that scored particularly highly. We had LNG as one of the more popular choices. This is obviously a fuel that is available today. There's obviously been some debate around its environmental credentials this year, but it was certainly valued as a fuel to assist with IMO 2030 compliance by our audience. Vessel operating efficiencies also scored very high as well. In fact, that was the highest of all of the tools that we put in front of them. And then a close third was the use of hydrogen, which also surprises me because it's not a widely available fuel at the moment. But nevertheless, this is what the audience seemed to reach some consensus on.
So that's interesting because, I mean, LNG probably has achieved scale now, I would say. There are perhaps 2,500 LNG-capable ships on the water or being built. And as 60% of marine fuels are delivered in six countries, or more than 60% of marine fuels are delivered in, I think it's China, Korea, Singapore, the UAE, the Netherlands, and the US are the six leading marine fuels delivery points. And there are LNG bunkers available in all of those places now. So there probably is enough LNG to bunker ships that wish to fuel with LNG. Hydrogen doesn't have that scale yet and is still very much at the experimental level, whether that's hydrogen fuel cells or hydrogen gas engines. So it was the vessel operating efficiencies that scored the highest then. So it was the use of current technology.
In a way, yes, which is obviously part of the operations path that we identified at the start of the session as well.
And I suppose that has some popularity because some of these vessel operating efficiencies can be retrofitted to existing fleet. There's no need to go and invest in a whole new ship or a whole new fleet of cargo ships.
Yeah, absolutely. You just sort of work much more efficiently with what you have. You know, companies will be looking more about how they deploy their fleets, where currents, weather. I mean, you name it. Anything to shave off a few carbon points would be welcome.
How about some of the other alternative fuels we've seen? A lot of interest in ammonia test beds recently. So Wärtsilä is working on ammonia engines. I know there are other organizations working on it. And then there's, of course, methanol, and we see more interest in biofuels recently. I was just writing a piece for the website ship.energy recently talking about how a number of US oil refiners are switching over to biofuels production. And there is, in fact, a bill gone before Congress at the end of September this year, I think, to increase the biofuel content of American road fuels from 11 to 30%, which would require a huge maize planting program, the addition of about 20% more maize planting in the US over what they currently do just to grow plants for fuel. Did any of those get any particular scores in your survey?
Yes. So biofuels, out of the ones you mentioned, biofuels was the more popular choice of our audience, which makes sense because, you know, biofuels is available now. You don't need to make any significant changes to your engines. The problems are that it's not. The biofuels are not available in the way that LNG is at the moment, and certainly nowhere near, you know, the traditional fossil based fuels as well. There are pockets of it available around the world, Northwest Europe, Rotterdam in particular, and in certain other locations as well. We've identified just 27 locations globally where you can actually buy biofuels, with another 10 that we've calculated to be coming on stream in the next year or so. There are some other sort of ancillary benefits to biofuels as well. There are some local government incentives in some locations where you can get rebates and that sort of thing. But it's not as straightforward as, you know, paying your $300 a ton for IFO. It's a more complex thing. Additionally, you mentioned that more refiners are going to be producing biofuels, and that's obviously good news, considering what we're talking today. But in certain locations, we're struggling to get refiners to produce big enough runs of biofuels to satisfy some of our customer base. So in that way, it doesn't necessarily. It's not always viable in all of the locations that we want it to be.
That's interesting. Are you finding, therefore, that it's your customer base that's coming to you and asking, "We'd like to source this IMO 2030 can fly it fuel if we can. Can you help us to discover it?"
Absolutely. I mean, the webinar last week was largely customer driven. We are being asked more questions about decarbonisation than we ever have before, which which I'm sure makes perfect sense to you, considering the way that this topic has been echoing louder and louder within maritime circles over the last 12 months. So, we have more customers coming to us, asking us about availability of LNG, of biofuels, asking us the more sort of head-scratching cerebral questions about what's going to be available in the more distant future. We can, of course, only tell them what we know. And for that reason, we've actually recently put together a database that sort of breaks down all of the different IMO 2030 compliant fuels, or at least fuels that help our customers get to IMO 2030 in a compliant state. And that's something that we'll be rolling out to our customers in the next week or so.
Okay, is that going to be made available generally or to LQM customers with logins and accounts with you?
It's going to be free. It's going to be available via our website, and we are still figuring out exactly how we deliver it to customers. At the moment, it just exists as all of these things do at the beginning in a very large spreadsheet, and we are currently working with our designers and developers to get it shaped up and put online.
Oh, great. Well, I look forward to being able to view that. It's I think going to be a useful tool for being able to monitor the availability of compliant fuels. Because of course, you'll know this, having been in the bunker trade for all of your career, as far as I can remember. And I think I first met you when you were at Lloyd's MIU. It doesn't matter what you're fueling with, the bunker buying challenge is always the same four things, as far as I can tell. It's getting the right fuel with the right spec at the right price in the right place. You know, those are the four challenges of availability. That's not going to change with new fuels, is it?
Absolutely, no, that's true. I mean, we obviously do most of our business around the broking and trading of fossil-based fuels, because that's where the market is now, and that element of the market will remain for many years to come. However, as I mentioned earlier, we are getting more questions now, and we are sort of preparing ourselves to have discussions with our customers around a wider spectrum of fuels. I don't think we can avoid elements of a multi-fuel future. There does seem to be a certain amount of consensus around that in the industry at the moment. But what I think is really interesting is that, you know, typically any discussions around price with a customer until now have always been broadly focused around crude oil movements, because, you know, it's a binary thing. Crude goes up, bunker prices go up, and crude goes down, bunker prices go down. And everybody understands that, and that's fine. However, you know, as we look to adopt more of these future fuels, as we described in the webinar last week, we're going to have to talk about, you know, why a wider spectrum of price drivers. You know, we need to think about agriculture. We need to think about the forestry market as well, if biofuels sort of go down their future into their future generations. LNG on its own, you know, as we've talked about before, it's really coming on stream in a big way. There's 46 locations where we've identified where you can procure bunkers, with another 42 planned and coming on stream soon. But we've also noticed that with regards to LNG pricing, the link between crude and LNG pricing isn't what it was before. LNG seems to be sort of carving its own way in terms of volatility. So this is something we're sort of actively wrapping our heads around at the moment. It's really interesting.
I know I must be going back 5 years. I was part of a project briefly that was looking into developing an LNG futures market, an LNG derivatives market, because it was perceived that the LNG price would decouple. The gas price and the oil prices would decouple, and indeed that's very much the case now. You know, they're both very low, but you know, gas is cheap as chips at the moment, and may well be for some time to come. But you know, whenever the volatility returns to prices, then something like a derivatives market would come in handy. We've seen the return of freight derivatives markets in the last couple of years as volatility has recovered. And the ship brokers are all sort of hustling to open derivatives broking desks again. So that kind of risk management will come back, or will come into the LNG markets at some point, I'm sure. Is that risk management something that you help your customers with?
Yes, absolutely. But at the moment, it's very much focused on the fossil-based fuels. The market is not mature enough yet to start packaging the risk management products around LNG yet. I mean, if you were an actor within the bunker sector, you would realize that LNG pricing is actually quite difficult at the moment, because it's, until recently, it's been largely a contract-based market where you have larger companies buying on contract from oil majors or similar over very long terms. And of course, those prices are private. They're not made public. We are seeing a little bit more of a spot market opening up for LNG now, which is good. But it is still challenging to get pricing. We are doing it, and we are forging ahead with that. And we're hoping to sort of be amongst the first to be able to sort of, offer more realistic, LNG prices on a regular basis, versus some of our peers at the moment.
Great. Well, I think a lot of the LNG pricing, of course, as you say, comes down to the fact that the market isn't very mature. But we've seen how marine fuels markets can mature very quickly. So, for instance, the VLSFO market has come on so fast, you know, after IMO 2020 was introduced this year, you know, the 0.5% sulfur market. Everyone was afraid that there wouldn't be enough of it. But now I hear from people that actually the difficulty with availability is sometimes with the old recipe 380 centerstoke not being available. Is that your experience?
It can be, yes. The higher sulfur market has become a bit more specialized. It's become a bit more contract based as well. Obviously, contracts between scrubs, tonnage, and suppliers is more common than it used to be for the high sulfur. So yes, you know, it's there's a as you well understand, demand for that product has reduced, and for that reason, the economies of scale around packaging it up and making it available in a multitude of places isn't as appealing as it used to be.
Mm. Can you foresee a time when mineral oil based fuels go the same way in across the spectrum? You know, whether it's low sulfur fuel or gas oil or whatever, you know, that they end up becoming specialized fuels in contracted quantities from the physical suppliers rather than freely traded fuels as people approach 2030.
I'm not sure. I mean, unlike you, Mark, I don't have a crystal ball, so I can't be sure. But when it comes to fossil-based fuel, you know, I see that playing a major role in maritime propulsion for many years, for decades, which I know doesn't really answer your question, but that's just my view.
Okay. All right. Well, I have to say, you know, it's whether it's LNG with some form of carbon capture and general more efficient engines and operational efficiencies, the industry has to work with the fleet it has at the moment, doesn't it? And will have to for some time to come. So you're probably right about that. And on that happy note, I think we're approaching the end of our allotted time. So, Daniel Rose, thank you so much for coming on to share those insights from your survey that you conducted with your own webinar viewers, and thank you for sharing the benefit of your own expertise and experience with our listeners.
You're very welcome. The survey is available on our website if anyone cares to take a look at lqm.com.
Thanks very much, lqm.com, everybody. Thank you, Daniel.